Welcome to On Social Health and Change, brought to you by Adler University. I'm your host, Hannah Stanley, and today we're talking about LGBTQ advocacy. In our first segment, we'll talk about the implications for a recent federal report officially condemning the practice of conversion therapy. Later on, we'll discuss what it means to be an ally in the LGBTQ community and how to raise transgender kids. With us currently is Josh Wolf, a professor of psychology at Adler. His research interests focus on the intersection of religion, spirituality, sexual orientation, and gender identity. And before we get started with Josh, I want to take a moment to remind you to hit subscribe so you don't miss a moment of this podcast. Josh, thanks so much for coming in.
Hi, Hannah. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Now, tell us about this new report, because I understand you had a big big role in creating it.
Sure. Well, I had a role in creating it. And what the report was it was released in the by SAMHSA, which is the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. They're an agency within the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I was part of a team of 13 mental health professionals who brought together research, clinical experience, and professional expertise from various disciplines, including psychology, psychiatry, and social work. And the reason that SAMHSA started working on this report was about a year ago, President Obama put out a statement from the White House condemning the use of conversion therapy, especially condemning it in the use of minors, children, and adolescents. And so as a result, it spurred a lot of movement and momentum within the federal government, within agencies, as well as professional organizations like the American Psychological Association, who actually hosted us for this working panel and helped facilitate this coming together. So over the period of several months, we reviewed research studies, discussed clinical experiences in working with LGBTQ youth, and I'm proud to say SAMHSA, with our input, issued a fairly strong report that pointed to evidence showing that conversion therapy is harmful, not appropriate for use in children and adolescents, and really does not have a place in professional psychology and counseling.
I feel that we would be doing a disservice if we didn't explain kind of just sort of an overview of what conversion therapy really is.
Sure. Good question. So the goal of conversion therapy is really to change someone's sexual orientation or gender identity. It's an express intent from a mental health or mental health professional to do that. So, for example, if individual who has attraction, is sexually attracted towards members of the same gender, if they were to seek out conversion therapy, it would be to try and change that, to make themselves heterosexual, is the goal of conversion therapy. Now, as I said earlier, the evidence is overwhelming that this doesn't work and is actually harmful. But this is something that's still happening today with mental health professionals, with what I call sort of paraprofessional organizations that aren't necessarily regulated by licensing boards or by professional organizations, as well as in religious faith-based communities that are not affirming toward lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, queer identities within individuals in their denominations or congregations.
You come to this topic from a very personal place, and I'd like to ask you to share your story.
Sure. So I grew up in as an evangelical Christian, and that's really an important part of my identity, and I think had many positive experiences and who I am today. But one of the things that, you know, I heard growing up, you know, I didn't always necessarily hear it, but somehow knew that I would not be fully accepted as a gay man in my faith community, and that it would be viewed as sinful and wrong displeasing to God to be gay. And that was something I carried for a very long time, and was a, I think something, I had a, was painful, had a lot of shame about. And I really believe that if I just kept praying hard enough, if I was a good enough Christian and did all the right things, that I could, that God would somehow change my sexual orientation to be attracted to women or to be heterosexual. And one of the ways that I thought I could do that would actually be through conversion therapy. So I actually saw a psychologist for about a year and a half, working on trying to make me straight or no longer make me gay. And there's some very vivid memories I have from that, such as my very first session with him. I pointedly asked, is this something you can help me with? And his response being, yes, I have worked with gay clients who have changed their sexual attractions, and I believe that is something that I can do with you. And this came from a licensed clinical psychologist. And at that point in my life, it was just something I just desperately wanted, and kind of hung on every word that this is going to work for me. And here's someone that is well-educated, licensed, someone I, am trusting, is telling me this over and over again for well over a year. I kept believing that until later, when things started to change for me. Not my sexual orientation didn't change. I was still exclusively attracted to men after being in this therapy for over a year and a half. And that's when I started to wonder, is this really helping me? And more doubts began to surface, particularly starting to think, this isn't helping me. I actually believe I started to get more depressed because I was spending all this time, all this money, all this energy, and then thinking, why is it not working? Maybe, is it me? Is it my fault that it's not working? I discontinued therapy. I ended it against my therapist's recommendations, who very adamantly insisted I was ending therapy prematurely, needed to continue. We hadn't done enough. He insisted if I kept going deeper into my issues, it would make me straight. But I really feel fortunate that I listened to my gut feeling that this was not healthy, and this was actually quite harmful, and discontinued seeing this person.
So based on the story that you just shared with us, tell us why. Very sorry. Tell us why you feel this report is so very important.
Well, I think it's important for a lot of reasons. And as I alluded to earlier, when you have the president of the United States coming out in support or against something, that carries a lot of weight. I think that this really energized a movement that had already been underway, but sort of kickstarted it to build momentum, to make sure that individuals can be protected against this practice, particularly individuals like minors, individuals under 18 who can be coerced, forced into these practices by parents, legal guardians, do not have the same protections under the law. They need an added layer of protection, which I think this report is something that can do. It's also another vehicle to illustrate some of the research on this topic that is really alarming. So, as I said earlier, not only does conversion therapy not work, there's evidence that it can actively harm people who undergo it. That can include increased rates of depression, substance abuse, as well as thoughts of suicide or suicide attempts when conversion therapy is not successful for individuals who seek it.
Especially with someone like yourself who sought it out on their own, mm-hmm. desperately wanted yep. the result that you were trying to achieve, and then became more depressed as you realized you mm-hmm. weren't going to get that to get to that point.
Exactly. And thinking, well, again, was it my fault? Or does that mean this will never change? And, you know, will God ever accept me, or whatever an individual's higher power might be? Will my family ever be able to accept me? Well, does that mean that I have to live the rest of my life in celibacy and alone? I mean, I think these are all possible thoughts that might go through someone's head when they really believe this is going to work for them and help them, and it doesn't.
Also important, in my opinion, is the fact that this report allows it, it's publicized, it's published, mm-hmm. it's out there, people can Google it. Mm-hmm. So if someone is considering this yep. and they do any sort of research, this is going to be something that they can read that's documentable, yep. that's cited.
Yeah, and it's actually free, downloadable to the public. I encourage listeners to visit www.samhsa.gov.
Which is SAMHSA.
SAMHSA.
Aha, see.
There's a hidden H in
there's
there.
There's a hidden silent H.
and again, you know, when you have a formal government document, it's been highly vetted to get to that level. You know, certainly our government's not perfect, but the federal government cannot just haphazardly release scientific and policy documents without going through numerous levels of clearance. And I think that adds, again, a significant amount of credibility to this report. It also creates a directive and policy recommendations and ideas for other states to follow. Right now, only 4 states, Illinois being one of them, as well as California, New Jersey, and Oregon, as well as the District of Columbia, have banned the use of conversion therapy with minors. New York has also taken some executive actions from the governor to make this much harder to get. So the report really provides resources for states, other government entities. One of the things the report did was called upon more research on how to protect LGBTQ youth, what are various risk factors that may explain how a LGBTQ youth ends up in conversion therapy, as well as how do we do better messaging to parents and legal guardians to keep kids out of those kind of treatments.
You mentioned that there are states where conversion therapy is illegal.
Mm-hmm.
Who does that cover? Is that just licensed therapists?
That's one of the criticisms of these laws, is those laws typically only cover licensed mental health professionals. Psychiatrists, psychologists, social workers, professional counselors.
Somebody who has to pass a board or
exactly,
report back in.
And is already held to high standards within their profession and state licensing board. And there's already a certain level of oversight if someone steps out of bounds with what is accepted in their professional licensing board or organization. Going to see a pastoral counselor in some states may not have the same oversight. Now, I'm not at all saying that all pastoral counselors are advocating conversion therapy. But at the same time, when we talk about this happening in, conversion therapy getaway camps or religious ministries or clergy members, LGBTQ youth lose some of the legal protections that they have if they were going to see a licensed mental health professional.
And is that because of a freedom of religion protection or envelope?
Yeah. I think that's a a complicated legal question and debate that's happening right now is this, where's the line between where the government allows for freedom of religion and also
protects the mental health of the youth.
And if I can make an analogy with this, and I think it's appropriate because I believe that it is this strong, is, you know, as a society, we have decided we do not protect anyone on the basis of religious freedom when it comes to child abuse, whether that's physical, emotional role you are in, no matter what role you are in. I raise that because the evidence is overwhelming that this is harmful, potentially coercive, abusive. I think we're having to relook at these laws and say, have we done enough to protect children who end up in this situation?
So for the states that are considering this, where are we? We have four that have banned it. District of Columbia is on board. Mm-hmm. And we, as a nation, mm-hmm. I'm saying, who is considering it? Where are we at as a country that
way? So several more states have considered it. I think this is something you're going to see popping up in various legislatures this year. My guess is we'll have 2 to 3, maybe more, added by the end of this year. There's also legislation that's been introduced in Congress to make it actually consumer fraud to tell an individual or family that you can change their sexual orientation or gender identity.
Because there's money being exchanged.
Exactly. Yep. And a billable service is being presented, or a fee exchanged. It'd be the same thing if someone offered you a loan that they knew was bad. They would be subject to prosecution under fraud charges. And again, I think that this legislation to say this is not different. If someone promises you something that is shown to be ineffective and harmful, you are accountable under the law for that. I think that the reality is that legislation has multiple hurdles it will encounter in the current Congress, and something we need to be realistic about. But there are efforts both at the state level as well as the federal level to do more to protect LGBTQ youth against conversion therapy.
Against conversion therapy, mm-hmm. which is what we've been discussing during this segment. Thank you so much, Josh,
sure.
for not only sharing a very incredibly personal story, but allowing us to learn from your experience and your involvement and expertise on this topic. When we come back, we're going to talk about how to create an inclusive environment for LGBT community, for LGBT people in general. Hannah Stanley here. This is on Social Health and Change, brought to you by Adler University. And again, just take a moment to hit subscribe so you don't miss a moment of this fine podcast. Back for part two of our episode, LGBTQ Advocacy. I'm Hannah Stanley, the host of On Social Health and Change, brought to you by Adler University. As always, I'm going to remind you to take a moment and hit subscribe on that button so that you don't miss a moment of this incredible content. With me is Peter G., a professor of psychology at Adler University, with expertise in developing and measuring heterosexual people's willingness and ability to be allies for the LGBTQ community. Peter, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for being here.
Oh, this is wonderful. Now, when you imagine an inclusive environment for LGBTQ community and the people, what exactly does that look like?
Well, I think inclusive would mean that you would feel safe and open to talk and share about whatever you want to regarding LGBTQ issues. I think that to be open about this means that whenever you want to, you can talk about this, you can share, and that you would not have to be concerned about what kind of response you would get. You would not have to be concerned about any repercussions or what it would mean. It's just that it is what it is, and you can talk about it in any way you want to. So that kind of openness and not having to worry about it would characterize an inclusive environment for me.
Does that also include the ability to not talk about it?
If necessary, yeah. I think that, it is our own personal choice to say, this is how I want to keep this issue for myself. And I think that I want to be as open about it as I need to be, and I need to be private about it as I need to be. And I think that in an environment, you have that choice. It doesn't mean that you have to be open about it, or you have to share, or that you have to close down. It's just that you have that choice, and whichever way you want to exercise that choice is just fine for you.
All right. Now, I was going to say on paper, but we're not writing this down. So just talking about it, you and I, sounds totally reasonable.
Right.
And where we are politically and socially, it feels like this is maybe more attainable, right?
It does seem like that. I mean, you can't but deny that socially and social media and just important laws that are passing advocating for LGBTQ equal rights sets the stage for it. And none of this could really happen at such a level that we are at right now without those social issues emerging. But to say that that would be all that was needed is probably not where we should just rest. I think that it takes an active approach to make an inclusive environment. We just can't assume that social climate and social acceptance is enough to put things into inclusive environment openness form.
All right, because I feel that everybody on Twitter is all like-minded and is, because they're very vocal about being supportive of gay marriage rights or mm-hmm. whatever, there's a whole lot of the population that either isn't voicing that or isn't on Twitter or whatever.
Well, we can't deny the fact that there will always be that, but I think for me that it's not so much an issue of supportive versus unsupportive. I think it's an issue of being openness to talk about anything that we feel is curious about and to extend these conversations. I think that people are, we can be, understandably nervous about, if I want to share that my daughter is getting married and it's part of a same-sex marriage, how would people respond to that? Now, it doesn't really have anything to do with, people are in support of gay marriage or not in support of gay marriage, but also people are just kind of supportive about, what was that like and how is it going to be? And in some ways, same-sex marriage and celebrating that is no different than heterosexual marriage. I get that. But without that open, active, open, inclusive environment, people can have some reservations about whether or not it's appropriate to share. Now, 9 times out of 10, it's usually very open and very appropriate, and people want to talk about that. But sometimes it can be very difficult to kind of say, I have to make the first move and let people know that I have a son or daughter that's involved in a same-sex marriage relationship, and would people really be accepting about it? And not just accepting, I'm sure they would be, but were they willing to engage in a conversation about it and really extend, how I feel about the whole issue.
All right. So obviously you're a researcher and you focus on this particular topic, but how do you and how would you suggest people have these conversations but really encourage others to be more supportive or more open to this?
Well, I think an openness is also about asking questions that may be taboo and maybe feel socially inappropriate. And these aren't exactly kind of water cooler conversations that people can just spontaneously bring up. And I think an open, inclusive environment says that those conversations can be brought up at any point in time. And it's how do we try to engage each other in those conversations rather than feeling like we have to have those conversations for fear of making it seem like we're being closed down about it. It's just more of the fact that anything we can do to try to initiate that these questions are appropriate to bring up at any time is probably the way to go for me. I think that it's just not that easy to do that because people would kind of wonder about how people are going to react to that. And most of the time it's favorable, but we have to be concerned about whether or not people have negative reactions about that, or just reactions about just what's it curious or what's it like. So,
we've done a podcast on diversity and inclusion, and one of the things that we talked about with our expert frequently was the fact that if you come to it from the right place, which is the place of wanting to be more knowledgeable and wanting to be more inclusive, mm-hmm. asking questions that could be interpreted awkwardly mm-hmm. or as uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. But if the person you're asking, if they know you're trying to do this to learn more, it makes it a lot less awkward.
Yeah, and I think it's hard to judge if your heart's in the right place. People don't know that unless you actively tell that. And it also, on the receiving end, you know, people do have this healthy curiosity. In order to be educated, we have to kind of start from awkward places. And that says nothing about your intentions. It's just that I like to think of this healthy curiosity. And I think that it's as much of an inclusive environment where people want to ask questions, but people have to be able to encourage that so that it's safe to ask awkward questions about LGBTQ and how do people feel about that. So, you know, and I think that no one wants to make a mistake. No one wants to make an error and saying, gosh, I hope I asked it in the wrong way and maybe inadvertently reveal a negative intention about myself. And that's always a concern. And I think that part of the inclusive environment is to say, I'm willing to hear whatever question you have in order to make it feel, because I know that you're in a healthy place of trying to be open and learn something about it.
Right, so that you can, like, this is a free space. This is an mm-hmm. open space. Ask me, and I can help you mm-hmm. fix that vocabulary. Because that way, if the person you're asking is open to being asked, mm-hmm. it really does help that person be more educated and help others.
Right, and nine times out of ten, these healthy questions really open up a whole new world of understanding. Like, I had not known that. I had not thought about that. I had not realized that that could be a possibility. And I think that usually people walk away from these conversations more enlightened rather than feeling like, oh my gosh, I had a deficit and I didn't know that. It's more like enlightenment that this is much larger issue than I really thought about. So.
Yeah, this is a large group that needs to have some diversity and inclusion education. Mm-hmm. While we spend a lot of time on different groupings for that, mm-hmm. this is I'm fascinated. I'm happy we're doing this topic, mm-hmm. really, mm-hmm. So that we can help with that education and help encourage people to ask questions that they have. Speaking of people asking questions, how do the students respond and how has that shifted over the past several years?
Well, I think for me, what I notice about students is that they all maintain that they're open-mindedness and they want to learn. Mm-hmm. And I think though, and that we all want to try to be aware of their biases and what's how they perceive things. What's interesting to me is that once you really put them in active situations or they're asking questions, you know, they come across things that they hadn't really known about and that it kind of it challenges their thinking, but in ways that feel like safe, like I had no idea about that before. So, you know, a new issue coming up is the idea of gender fluidity and transgender mm-hmm. and how that can be that a person can feel like they're not, that their biological body isn't quite right for them, and what that sensation or feeling could be like, and how do we help people realize that it can happen, and that people do have those kind of choices to say that this body isn't really what I want for myself, and how does that happen, and how does it happen, and to have students say, you know, how could that have? Your biological sex is your biological sex. Either a man or a woman, how can that be? And to get them involved with organizations and people telling their stories that it can be different mm-hmm. and it can feel different, and to believe them. And I think that students appreciate the opportunity where their open-mindedness gets stretched and challenged in ways they never thought of before. And I think in the end, they feel stronger because of it, because it's like now they really know what it means to be truly challenged by being open-minded about that there are many possibilities about our gender identity and our sexuality that need to be appreciated and validated. So.
And these are students at Adler. Mm-hmm. So they're learning to mm-hmm. help others with their struggles right. and with therapy and things that they would need. So to have them be as open-minded as possible
right.
would really be ideal, because these could be their future patients.
Well, that's what we try to say. And I try to make it out to be like, you know, we should learn how to expand and be open about these kinds of things, because you never know who will be coming into your office as a client. Not so much as a get prepared kind of thing, but to kind of say that there's a lot of joy in it. There's a lot of joy in learning about things that you didn't know about. There's a lot of joy in understanding other people's experiences. And there's a lot of joy in being the person that even though you're not like me, you're doing everything you can to connect and understand me. And what a breath of fresh air that is, because we can't be like everybody else to understand everybody else. But it's such a breath of fresh air that someone who's not like you is doing everything they can to understand you for who you are and how you want to present yourself. And not just say, like, this is who you are, but to say, like, that, you know, I appreciate everything you have to share for me with me about this because it's important to me.
It seems like this could be a topic that would have some opposing views within the classroom. Mm-hmm. How is that managed?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, you would think that a student who signs up for a course about LGBTQ issues has some motivation to be there. And that's not always the case. Students take courses because it's an elective that fits their schedule.
That's valid.
And so it's like, well,
don't be embarrassed by that, people. We've all been there. Yeah.
I need the course. I need the credit. I need to graduate. There's the course that's available. Well, lo and behold, LGBTQ courses.
All right.
Open up. Yeah, exactly.
How hard can that be?
Yeah, exactly. How hard could that be? And, you know, and I think that my main goal for that, though, is to keep students in the classroom, that whatever struggles they may have about this issue, it does me no good to say that you're doing it wrong and that means that it pushes them out of the classroom. In order for me to kind of work with this, they need to stay in the classroom. So a lot of times I validate their beliefs. I validate the fact that they may have, like, say, religious concerns about this. I validate the fact that, you know, they feel that marriages should be between a man and a woman. Even within the gay lesbian community, for example, like with bisexuality, making sure that, you know, bisexuality, could that be just a transition? No, it's a real valid way of looking at it. And even people who thought they were open-minded about it may feel some struggles about things they've never encountered before. And I think that's important to feel like, you know, that can happen. And I'm with you to try to help you on to kind of wrap your head around it. And I think it all comes from a place of healthy curiosity rather than this is something I'm against. And I think that when people are against something, I find they're not exactly against everything. They're just maybe like one part of it they're against. And that can happen. You know, what can we do to try to make it more malleable? What can we do to find a way that we don't have to, like, make sure we kick out these issues that you're having and meet them head on? You know, there's other parts of being LGBTQ that should be embraced. And why don't we talk about those things that they're willing to embrace? So,
are you finding that the parts that they're uncomfortable about, they just don't know about? And I don't want to say ignorance, because that's not really exactly what I'm going for, but they're just unaware of some of it.
I think unaware, but I think it's also like knowing from afar and like,
or the rumors.
Right, exactly. It's like, okay, well, I've take transgender surgery, and, you know, is it really that, is being transgender a phase? They're trying to figure out what their gender identity is, you know.
Right.
And the issue, and it's, so that's what they know or kind of know from afar. And I think that trying to get them to hear the stories about how people really didn't think of it as a phase, it is who they are, and trying to embrace that to try to help feel like, okay, I'm in a safe environment where I can try to amend my thoughts about this. So, you know, people's views come from someplace, and I think that we have to appreciate the fact that it's sometimes hard to let those views go. Religious issues are very hard. You grew up in a religious, practicing religion, and it's very important, and your faith in God is very important to you. And so the idea that being gay is a sin, if you grew up with that, it's hard to let that go. And, you know, what can we do to study the Bible? Where does it say that? How do people are affected by reconciling being gay and being religious? How do we reconcile being Jewish and gay? How do we reconcile being Catholic and gay? And, you know, what have people said that tried to bridge those two things together, and to try to help people get their head wrapped around that both sides can coexist peacefully? And so I think that trying to encourage them that there is a way around this, there is a way to kind of make this happen for yourself. And I think that that's the important thing, I think, for me, I try to instill in my students with the class. So.
And the students who will then help instill that in people that they will be helping to treat, working with therapy, or just helping other people become comfortable with these ideas as well.
Right. Well, that's what it means to be an inclusive environment. Someone needs to take the lead on this. Someone needs to say that it's possible, it can happen, and it can be done with a sense of joy rather than I have to do this. And I think when students are open about their own struggles with this, like I struggle with this too, that makes it a whole lot easier because it doesn't say that a person who wants to try to create an open environment is above you and is like knows better than you. You want people to feel like being inclusive means that anybody can do it and that anybody can do it from any place they want to. No one is like a specialist in this.
You're not the intellectual shaman.
No, you're not. You're not. And that places distance.
Yes.
You know, you want people to feel like they're like you in terms of like, you know, just because I'm trying to make an inclusive environment doesn't mean I know everything about this or I'm free of all prejudices and bias about this. I think that we want to create situations where people can welcome that they can and should.
Welcome
and
what they don't know.
Exactly. Right.
As well as because then you can constantly be evolving.
Exactly. Right. Right.
This is fascinating. All right. This is I have to think that there's questions that people are embarrassed to ask in mm-hmm. class because they either don't want other people to be uncomfortable or they are embarrassed that they don't know the answer. Mm-hmm. Let's go over some of those so we can knock those out of the water and mm-hmm. have people feel better.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think being a gay or lesbian, you know, how did you know it? Were you sure that you were gay? Was it a phase? Did you have to kiss somebody in order to realize that you had those erotic feelings and that's how you knew that you were gay? And, you know, those kinds of questions, I think, you know, it gets into people's private lives about that, you know. And, you know, transgender, how did you know that if it wasn't really just being a tomboy, were you just, you know, how did you know it was truly this, that you were a girl and you wanted to be a boy? How did you know that it wasn't just being a tomboy and that it was really a change in your biological sex? How do people deal with the AIDS epidemic and trying to avoid that? You know, parents, when they, it's like, my son's gay, do I have to worry about him with HIV and AIDS status? Or not just so much that, with parents like worried, like, you know, how do I make sure that my son is safe, my daughter is safe, and that he or she won't have to endure any kind of backlash for who she is? How do I ensure that? And, you know, other difficult questions. Is there a biological basis for being gay? Are people born gay? Can they not help who they are? And that's why we should be involved in equal rights. Those are some awkward questions to ask. And I think that, does the Bible really say, is there a passage in the Bible that really says that being gay is a sin? And I think I try to take the class opportunity to say, let's take a look at that issue. Let's take a look at the Bible and let's take a look at the passages that people claim that says that being gay is a sin. Let's take a look at the literature about whether or not being a tomboy really is part of the phase of being transgender. Turns out none of that is really quite holding water. But I think the class for me is like, where else would you get the opportunity to ask these difficult, embarrassing questions and have the opportunity to indulge yourself in a fact-finding mission to find this all out? And not just fact-finding, but just experience-finding. That's, you know, talk to people and talk to a gay priest. Talk to a lesbian person with AIDS. Talk to a gay person who went through conversion therapy, and you know what was that like, and what the effects were, and so that we can experience it firsthand.
I feel like, and you said conversion therapy, and that's a trigger word for me, where I was like, but I've talked about this on the air before, mm-hmm. and had really angry people talking about it, and it's very interesting because it's so polarizing. But given the fact that that was one that makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up, mm-hmm. And you as well, it looks like, when you do bring things like that up in class, over the course of the class, it feels like this has got to be very emotional and very maybe even draining mm-hmm. for the students to kind of process all of this. How does the curriculum end?
It ends with students. I try to make sure I do a follow-up reaction paper to them to say, like, to make sure I give them time to process. What were you like when you started the class, and what were you like at the end of the class? And to me, the issue is growth. Like, how much did you feel you expanded? How much did you feel you learned? But also that the confidence that I can do this on my own. Once I leave the class, I'm confident that I know how to ask questions. I'm confident I have the experience of asking awkward questions. I'm confident in the fact that I know that it's important for me to look up a website and try to understand information. I'm confident for me that I can now go into a gay religious service and not feel like so much I'm a stranger there. I can actually go in there and participate and be a part of it. And I think that the growth is the confidence that I can grow and do more with this as I see fit is the kind of bottom line lesson I hope that the students get out of this. They don't have to feel like the LGBTQ issue is another thing that's not part of me, or that I'm not qualified, or I don't have the credentials to say something about that. At the end of the course, I hope that the students feel confident that if they want to continue, that they can do it from a position of strength and confidence, rather than feel like I have to, or I don't know anything, or I there's something about me that makes me unqualified to do this.
So they've navigated these waters before.
Right, exactly.
They can go a little bit further out next journey.
Exactly. I mean, the thing is, for me, when I first started the course, I didn't have the confidence to teach everything in the course that I do now. I mean, there were some things I didn't feel ready to teach, transgender being one of them. I didn't feel like I knew enough or felt comfortable with asking all the questions I wanted to. Religion was something I didn't really feel comfortable. I knew that was very polarizing. So how do I train myself and get myself into a position where I feel like I could teach that comfortably and confidently? That wasn't easy. So I think, you know, telling students that I had my own journey about which topics I wanted to talk about and which ones I didn't feel ready yet, try to humanize that process. So.
It definitely makes it less polarizing, which is the word we used earlier, mm-hmm. but definitely where they can identify mm-hmm. With that as well. Now, as individuals, it seems, you know, you're talking to a classroom of students. They're all going to have their own individual opinion. But if an organization wanted to be more inclusive and help to educate their people, mm-hmm. how would you recommend they approach that?
In the past, I've been invited to talk to like a diversity luncheons, and I think I give us a conversation similar to what I'm having now, where, you know, what does it really mean to be open and inclusive? What does it mean to encourage these questions? What does it mean to have good intentions but not know what to do with them? And I think for me, and that was all well and good. I would say this: I wish I did some follow up. Like, someone has to take an active lead to say, okay, what do we do with the resources and the motivation that we have now to come up with a plan to say, okay, what can we do to make this more inclusive? What can we do to build the knowledge? What can we do to build the experience? What can we do to build the education so that people feel more this is inclusiveness is coming from a position of strength and desire rather than I have to do this or I better do it for fear of being accused of not being inclusive. Mm-hmm. And so how do we switch that mind frame where there's more joy in it rather than stress about it? And I think for me, if I had my way about it, I would pattern it to similar to the class I teach, where, you know, each week is a topic that we want to talk about, that we want to set aside. You want to talk about transgender and work rights? Do we want to talk about transgender in the bathroom? Do we want to talk about bisexuality and how do bisexuals, how do they maintain monogamous relationships while still appreciating their bisexuality? How do we talk about youth who feel like they're LGB at such a young age? And how do we talk about dating in LGBT land? I think that, you know, each week trying to set aside a topic that, you know, that's curious, so that people get comfortable with the fact that I really want to be aware of everything that I can.
Peter, this has been really, really interesting, and I thank you so much for your time and for the knowledge you've brought to us, and just thank you again. Be sure, listeners, to stay with us for part three, which we're going to talk about raising gender-fluid kids. And again, I do ask you to hit subscribe so you don't miss a moment. Hannah Stanley, this is on Social Health and Change, brought to you by Adler University. Welcome back to part three of our episode on LGBTQ advocacy. I'm Hannah Stanley, host of On Social Health and Change, brought to you by Adler University. Joining us now is Jason Troutman, professor of psychology and an expert on transgender issues in the military, as well as in children and adolescents. And again, before I start, I want to make sure to remind you to take a second and hit subscribe so that you don't miss a moment of our podcast. Jason, thank you so much for being here. I appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. Now, before we talk about parenting, can you clear up for our listeners some of the terms we're going to be discussing today so we kind of have a glossary?
Yeah. There's some major terms associated with the transgender community, and I'll just cover sort of the major terms, although there are a number of terms, right, with the community. The big one is sex versus gender. So I think a lot of people in society tend to confuse sex versus gender and what is sex versus what is gender. Sex is that's assigned at birth, and it comes along with biological markers, physical characteristics, right? And it's determined at birth, right? Whereas gender is something that can be a felt sense of identity or a way that one expresses themselves that fits into a certain model or prototype within a society. Okay, so in our society, in America, right, we have certain attire and dress and apparel and ways of behaving, ways of expressing emotions that are more considered more socially appropriate, right?
By socially the norm.
Socially the norm, mm-hmm. right? And sort of policed in that way implicitly by larger society, right? So that's what gender is. Gender is something that society, right, has created about the meaning that's assigned to these different biological characteristics that are observable at birth, right? So it's the dress, it's the ways of conducting oneself, it's mannerisms, it's ways of expressing emotions and emotionality. These are the things that society says comes along with the sex or the sex that you are assigned at birth, right? So it's important to distinguish then, yet sex is something that is observable, physical, tangible, right? Gender is something that's socially constructed, right? It's something that's created by a society, and it varies society to society. Then there's, within gender, there's two major types of gender, right? There's gender identity, and then there's gender expression. So gender identity is the synonymous sort of or similar to sexual identity. It's a felt sense about who you are, right? That's what gender identity is. It's a felt sense about who you are. So if someone says that I identify as male or female, that's the felt sense that they have about who they are as a person. Versus gender expression, which are the way that a person displays their gender within a society or within a culture. So it may be the clothing that they wear, again, the way they express emotions, right? So there's two components then to gender, right? Gender is the internal felt self and then the observable to others, right? So the internal felt self is the identity, and the observable to others is the expression of that gender. And they don't always have to go hand in hand. So a person could have a different gender identity than than they do gender expression. So they could identify as female, but dress as male, right? And pass as male within a society or within a culture, but internally they still feel female. Right. So that's the difference between gender identity and gender expression. One's observable by the other, one's felt by the person. Another term then is cisgender. Cisgender is when a person's biological sex at birth matches the societal, socially constructed gender that's assigned to that biological sex. So if a person is biologically born male, of sex and identifies as male, then they are considered cisgender, right? So this composes most of the population, probably 99 to 97% of the general population identifies as cisgender, being that their biological sex matches their gender identity. And those people then that do not, their biological sex they see as opposite from their gender identity would be transgender individuals. Okay, so if they are biologically identified as male at birth and they identify as female, right, for their gender identity, then the person is considered transgender. And gender fluid then would be all the people that don't necessarily maybe identify as male or female. Maybe they identify as queer. Maybe they identify as more male of body, right? But not completely male, or more female of body, but not completely female. In reality, besides the policing and people trying to sort of fit within a model within a society, most people probably have some gender fluidity to them. Right?
Can you define for me queer?
Queer?
Please.
Queer is traditionally a political term. So queer involves queer politics, right? And queer politics are related to the deconstruction of language policies, right? Language systems, societal systems that are created to police a certain person's way of being in the world.
So right. When someone identifies as queer,
they're saying, don't put me in a box. And that could be related to gender. It could be related to sexual orientation. It could be related to anything. Essentially, they're saying, I do not want labels assigned to me. Right. So if somebody says that they identify as queer, other people may see that as them identifying, you know, as assigning them as gay, right, or lesbian. And they're saying, no, I'm queer. That's saying, don't put me in a box because I'm just interested in people that I'm interested in. And today it might be a man. Tomorrow it might be someone who identifies as a woman. It might be someone who identifies as transgender. And I don't necessarily identify as bisexual either, right? Because it's I'm also interested in transgender people. So where do transgender people fit in the bisexuality spectrum? Right.
Okay. So it allows them to identify with a community without actually labeling themselves one of the other.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for clarifying that because I think it was important that we share. Mm-hmm. For parents who might be listening or who wonder about their children, what are some of the signs that they should look for or could consider that their child might be transgender?
This becomes a age and a developmental issue. It depends on largely depends on the age of the child. But sort of a traditional trajectory, and for a transgender person, at a very young age, the child may start to prefer, right, opposite gender clothing, opposite gender toys. They probably will not be able to express this as I feel like I'm a boy and really you're telling me that I'm a girl, right? They're probably not going to be able to express it in that fashion. It will be more expressed in preferences for clothing, preferences for play toys, and maybe an expression of I feel there's something different about me from other people. But I'm not sure what that is, right? So it may come across as like there's something different about me. I don't feel like I fit in with the kids at school.
And how early could people pick up on that, or how early can the children express that?
Oh, all the way down to age 3, 4 is young, almost as young back, right, as a child is able to walk.
Mm-hmm. And at what point do the parents realize this isn't just a phase. She doesn't, my daughter doesn't want to play with trucks because trucks are interesting and she really likes to know how things work. She could be an engineer, that this is something that she's, as you mentioned, dismissing girl, you know, clothing and wants to dress like a boy or whatever. This isn't, when do the parents go, this isn't just a phase. This is who she is.
Yes.
Or he.
Well, usually following then an early youth, right, the sort of expression of preference for clothes, preference for toys of opposite sex or of opposite gender, then oftentimes there will be a period where the child sort of you know, during those middle school years, it becomes very important for children to fit in with other kids. So all of these, you know, preferences may go dormant completely for a while because the dominant preference at that point is fitting in with others.
Not being teased.
Not being teased. I want to fit in. I want to relate to my peers, right? And these signs may vanish, right, for a certain period of time. But then most likely they will reemerge somewhere a little bit later in puberty, right, maybe 14, 15 years of age, and the or at the beginning of puberty even. And at that point, then the child or adolescent will probably be able to begin expressing that they feel that they're actually female, right? Or they feel that they're actually male, right? Even though you've identified them as the opposite at one point. So at that point, it's pretty clear, right? If the person follows this sort of trajectory, that it's most likely the case that this is not going to shift and the person does identify as gender fluid or transgender.
Now, once that's been established, that the child is in fact transgender, given whatever age it happens to be established as accepted fact, what do people need to, what do the parents need to know? What do they need to help with their kids to help with that?
Well, there's a lot of additional information, right, and resources that parents would want to gather at that time. I think the most important thing that parents can remember is that this is still their child, right, regardless of, I think parents can get very hung up on, right, I had a boy, I had a girl, right, and they get used to that, right? And sometimes they're like, yay, we had a boy, right? And now their child identifies as female later on. And this can cause a lot of despair, I think, and distress for parents. So I think foremost, it's important that parents address their emotional issues and needs, right, that come up as their child is identifying as transgendered, so that those don't leak out, right, into the relationship with their child, right?
Because, yeah, walking their daughter down the aisle is not going to be a dream that will be fulfilled.
No, no. And in general, as a system, it's not going to create a healthy family system either, right? Even if it's the model and the ideal type, it's going to create distress for every member of the family, right?
To not be insensitive, but this is a complicated storyline for any family, any individual who's going through this. But at some point, it is likely there will be conversation about transitioning, either living in that manner, changing your name legally, and then on to surgeries. When and how do those conversations come up?
Well, they would usually they would come up as a conversation between the parent, right, and the child as the child is expressing, right, ideas around transitioning, which is becoming more and more common in society, right, as children are becoming more aware of the possibility of hormones. So this would be a conversation probably that would begin to occur with the parents, right, but then would also at some point involve a trans-friendly medical provider, someone that would actually prescribe hormones as part of the transition. I think for parents, it would, at that point, it would, if the person, the child or adolescent was expressing that they would like to transition, then it would probably be best to listen to the child's interest, and then to seek out consultation with a medical provider, a physician that works with members of the transgender community extensively. And then at that point, it's important to be aware that the earlier that a person decides to transition, the more successful the transition will be regarding physical characteristics. So androgens have a powerful effect on the body, and they masculinize the body. So they create facial hair, they create chest hair, arm hair, Adam's apple. Once many of those changes go into place, they're fixed. If a person is prescribed an androgen blocker and estrogen, they will, except for genitalia, they will almost completely transition or go through female puberty. So then later on, it does not become the problem of correcting with surgery some of the masculinizing effects that androgens have created. So I think it's important for parents to be aware to take this expressed interest by their child seriously, because many of the effects are not reversible, only reversible through surgery. And the earlier that the transition could get started, more likely that the child or adolescent would feel more pleased with their body.
Mm-hmm. Which can alleviate at least some of potential concerns for not only the individual, but the parents as well. As parents, we want our children to have a safe, happy world around them. To that point, how do we as parents allow our children to be in a safe environment? How can we put them in a supportive community?
I think it's important, one, that a transgender child or gender fluid child has the ability to contact a parent at any time for a sense of safety. So nowadays we have cell phones. That's more easily taken care of. I think it would then also be important that parents talk with school administrators, faculty, to ensure that the school that they're sending their child to has trans-inclusive and friendly policies, such as locker room changing policies, restroom policies. These become very large issues for people that identify as transgender. So I would be looking for a school that has faculty that have received training, attended lectures, have invited guest speakers on transgender issues to implement school policies and be educated on having transgender students. And then I think an additional thing for parents to consider is dating. There is this concern, right, that if a person is transgender and they are dating someone, that kissing can quickly lead to touching, right, and that that this can place the child in harm's way because the other person could may be surprised by the person's sex, right? Mm-hmm. So I think it's important for parents to be able to have good conversations with their child about sex and letting dates know early on of the transgender identity. And parents talking with the child about how to have that conversation with dating partners before it leads to kissing, right, and more sexual activity. Mm-hmm.
I fear for parents who are making these calls and asking these questions that it could lead to backlash in people who are not inclusive. Mm-hmm. We're saying, this parent just called me, I wonder why, and then the gossip. How can they go through the research process without necessarily tipping their hat to the fact that their child could be transgender? Where are there safe websites that would list these schools and things?
There are plenty of transgender websites, and there's actually a lot of transgender chat rooms because in an urban setting like Chicago, there's a good transgender community, right? So And there's the Howard Brown Health Center. There's the Center on Halsted. We have these resources that parents or children can go to for transgender issues, right? Education, knowledge. But there's also chat rooms and such where parents can ask these questions, right, and gather this information. Mm-hmm.
So they can find safe spaces online to then find safe spaces in person.
Yes, and because, like I said, with Chicago, there are safe spaces in person locally. It's kind of unique in that it's a large city and has two community agencies, but many people live in rural settings.
This could be heard anywhere.
This could be heard anywhere. And even if there's a Parents for Lesbian and Gay organization,
which
or
is
group
PFLAG.
There, PFLAG, they may not necessarily be trans knowledgeable or trans friendly. So for people living in rural settings, then these online resources, chat rooms, right, become even more important, I think, for transgender parents and the children to feel that they have a sense of community.
Because that's what we all want.
Mm-hmm.
Each individual, we mentioned earlier that kids, and you said this, it was a very interesting point, that some of these feelings could almost go dormant during the middle school years because all they're trying to do is fit in and not be teased. And that's true for anyone.
Yes. So, with all these issues, it really is the role of the larger minority or majority community to create a sense of a community that is welcoming to individuals of difference, right, regardless of what difference they hold, including transgender issues, right? And if that were the case in schools, right, then transgender children wouldn't have this phase where they sort of feel like they need to go back in the closet, so to speak, to fit in if schools were, you know, educated and people were accepting and inclusive of other individuals, then everybody would have a sense of community, and it would work out well for everyone.
Jason, thank you so much for your time and your explanations and your expertise on this topic. That's going to conclude our show on this topic. Please join us next week, or you can just continue along if you're joining us later, for our episode is going to be on Facing Disaster. Again, this is on Social Health and Change, brought to you by Adler University. I am Hannah Stanley, and I ask you again to try to take a moment and subscribe to our podcast so you don't miss a moment. Thanks so much for listening. Thank you.